Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, September 14, 2017, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleform conference call. This afternoon, our conversation will be about law firm preferences. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are lucky to have with us Kurt Levy, who is the president of the Committee for Justice and the Legal Affairs Fellow at Freedom Works. Kurt will be talking with me through a few questions for the beginning portion of this call, and afterwards, we will be moving to an audience Q&A. Just to freshen all of us up on the subject for the conversation today, the description on our website, you can find it in the events page for this teleform, has this description to it. Major American corporations are pressuring their outside law firms to meet diversity goals both firm-wide and in the legal teams assigned to the company's work. For example, Facebook announced this year that the law firm teams working on its matters must consist of at least 33% women and minorities. This pressure has resulted in the widespread use of race and gender preferences in hiring, promotion, and work assignments decisions by America's premier law firms. Are these preferences legal under Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act? Are they good policy? And now we turn to Kurt Levy. Kurt, would you please tell us more about the pressure big corporations are putting on the law firms to have more diversity?
Yes. This is not new, but we're seeing a recent increase in it. Maybe for about the last decade or so, big corporations, particularly Fortune 500 companies, have been pressuring their outside law firms to have more racial and gender diversity in terms of the attorneys at the firms as a whole, working on the particular matters for that corporation, within the ranks of partner, they want more diversity, and sometimes these are phrased as suggestions, sometimes they're absolute requirements. Several of these big corporations have already admitted to firing law firms because they did not get the increases in racial and gender diversity that they wanted. As the general counsel of one company said, and this is a quote, if your numbers don't add up, your history. And so this has been going on for about a decade. There was a wave of it about 10 years ago, and now this year we've seen a lot of Fortune 500 companies announcing policies like this or going out of their way to point out that they have policies such as that. 500 corporations about 10 years ago signed a statement pledging to give, weight to law firms, racial and gender diversity. And at the time, I tended to, think that it was a result of pressure from civil rights activists, one might even say shakedowns by Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and people like that. But, I think it's sort of harder to blame it on that 10 years later when we see Fortune 500 companies becoming really their own center of political correctness, especially tech companies, so that now I don't even think it requires any pressure on the corporations. I think they're more than happy to announce that they're increasing not just their own diversity, but the diversity of the law firms that they hire. And, might not be surprised to know that this type of pressure from the corporate clients has been effective. I'll quote here from one partner who said that race and gender have become part of law firms' consciousness about what it takes to get business. although looking at their colleagues through the prison of race and gender is still outside of some people's comfort zone. Give them a business reason to do it, and it will happen. So, you know, what that partner is basically saying there is, you know, well, you know, some people might have been race blind or gender blind, but give them a reason to be race conscious and gender conscious, and they will be, which in my view at least is, you know, is a shame. So, you know, more recently, like I sort of alluded to, we've had a bunch of the tech companies jumping on this bandwagon. Facebook was quite vocal about instituting a policy, as you mentioned, in which they said at least 33% of the teams working on their legal matters must consist of women and minorities. And they're looking not just for numbers. Again, to read from their policy, it says that law firms must also show that they actively identify and create clear and measurable leadership opportunities for women and minorities when they represent the company in litigation and other legal matters. So, you know, they're looking for women and minorities to be the lead partner, to, you know, do the argument in the courtroom, so on and so forth. Now, maybe Facebook is trying to make up for its own inadequacies in terms of diversity, because at least according to the statistics that were released last year, they're not doing so good in terms of diverse leadership. I believe blacks accounted for 3% of leadership and Hispanics accounted for another 3%. So maybe they figure it's easier to pressure outside firms than to have their own diversity. And then some of this sort of newest round of pressure also includes requirements for diversity and sexual orientation and even disability. As you can imagine, the sexual orientation part was not present when I first studied this about 10 years ago. And again, I think, you know, we can look to a lot of evidence that, you know, these Fortune 500 companies, especially in the tech sector, have really become their own, as I said, centers of political correctness in terms of, you know, speech, diversity, political correctness, you know, to the point where I don't know that they really need any pressure from Jesse Jackson or anyone else. And but, you know, it's funny, although they're proud of it, we couldn't get any of them to participate in this panel. I know I reached out to about 10 big corporations that had been public about their diversity programs, and none of them wanted to participate. And I know the Federalist Society reached out to a bunch of law firms to see if they wanted to participate, and none of them did. So I guess somewhere in the back of their minds, they know that this may not all be legal.
Now, Kurt, you mentioned that this emphasis has been going on for at least a decade. Do you find that the pressure is at its highest point right now?
Yes, I do. Again, there was sort of a pressure point about 10 years ago, and I don't, you know, it's sort of hard to tell exactly since a lot of this is done in private, but it seemed to sort of, you know, slacken. And then now when we seem to have more political correctness and diversity concerns in society than we've ever had before, that's falling a lot on these law firms. So, you know, in my view, they are coming under the most pressure they've ever been under.
Now, is it unlawful for these law firms to comply with corporate clients' demands for racial diversity?
Well, you know, it depends how they do it. If they're, you know, just doing it through more aggressive outreach to minorities, I mean, the courts have generally been okay with sort of discrimination and outreach, for lack of a better word. If they're, you know, creating diversity committees and hiring diversity consultants, that's, you know, that's okay too, if it doesn't go beyond that. But too often it appears that these firms are using a different hiring standard for minorities and to some extent for women. Rick Sander, a law professor, did some good work on this, and you know, he found that the again, you know, the law firms don't disclose the size of the preference, but you know, given his statistics, it appears to be quite large. Where in general, the you know, the white new associates had finished well above 50% on average in their class, and the you know, the black associates had finished quite close to the bottom on average in their class. So I think we can infer from that, much as we sort of do from the test and grade gap in admissions, that you know, even if law firms or universities are not admitting that they're using preferences, it's pretty hard to explain the you know, the gap in the you know, the statistics between whites and minorities without without there being preferences. There just have to be. So, you know, let's assume, let's limit ourselves to law firms that actually are using preferences to some degree. And in that case, you're really talking about, you know, two federal anti-discrimination statutes that they could be violating, Title VII and perhaps the somewhat less known 42 U.S.C. 1981. You know, it's certainly my position that the law firms that are, you know, engaging in preferences are violating both of those laws. You know, those laws could also be used, let me say sort of before I get into the details, that one could also imagine a suit against the corporations bringing this pressure. And that would probably involve, in that case, you couldn't use Title VII, but I think you could use 1981, which is, you know, broadly applies to discrimination in the context of contracts. I'm not going to focus on that because that would be a sort of a whole nother analysis. I'm going to focus on the law firm liability, but, you know, keep in mind that the corporations have liability as well. So, again, I think this audience is familiar with, you know, Title VII, which comes from the 64 Civil Rights Act, and Section 1981, which goes right back to after the Civil War. And, you know, you might ask, why would you even want to use 1981 other than if you were suing the corporations? You know, one reason is just, you know, two is better than one, but also under 1981, you could hold the partners and arguably really any of the supervisors at the law firm personally liable. So that would be, you know, whereas Title VII is against the employer. So, you know, that would be one sort of substantive reason to do it. And, you know, this would apply not just to discrimination in hiring, but also discrimination in promotion or even work assignments. I think it's pretty clear that, you know, work assignments that affect your advancement, you know, do fall under Title VII. And, you know, let's face it, at big law firms, you know, who gets to do the work of the most prestigious clients? It's certainly a big, big factor in advancement. Certainly who gets to, you know, lead the effort and who gets to argue in court are, again, enormous factors in advancement. So let's, you know, let's start with the case where that we believe to be true, which is where these law firms are not doing this because they necessarily care about diversity themselves, but because they want to retain these corporate clients. Well, when Title VII was being debated back in the early 60s, there was, you know, discussion of this very problem of what happens if customer preferences, you know, do customer preferences, I should say, justify the use of racial preferences? And some people argued that there should be an exception in there, that you're not really discriminating if you're just trying to satisfy your customers. And ultimately, you know, that exception and more generally the idea of a, you know, a bona fide occupational qualification of race were were left out of Title VII with regard to race, because people felt like the only way that you're going to get rid of discrimination is to, you know, change what customers want as much as what the employers are doing. But, you know, I think we see that old habits die hard, and, you know, there's just as much sort of willingness to discriminate on the part of law firms today as, say, there was to, hire white waiters 50 years ago because your customers wouldn't like black waiters. It's, you know, at the end of the day, it's in my mind, the same sort of cynical game. Now, 1981 would be, you know, sometimes, as you can imagine, courts don't want to do a whole separate analysis for 1981, so typically they analyze it under the same standards as Title VII or equal protection. Typically, you'd use Title VII if it's a private employer and equal protection if it's a public employer, but, you know, I've seen that mixed as well. You know, equal protection is even less forgiving than Title VII of reverse discrimination. So that's not going to help you if this is evaluated under strict scrutiny. You know, really the only three reasons that courts have given for where race is a compelling interest under equal protection really wouldn't apply here. I mean, a national security emergency, remedying your own past discrimination. These big law firms have been, you know, diverse for a long time, and, you know, that excuse doesn't apply to remedying societal discrimination. It would have to be the law firm's own discrimination, which they're not going to admit to anyway. And then, of course, you know, out of Grotz and Grutter, we have, you know, fostering the educational benefits of racial diversity on a university campus. But for a variety of reasons, you know, that really doesn't apply to a law firm. So, you know, if it's going to be under equal protection, they're not going to win there. If it's going to be under Title VII, then you know, the idea that we're doing this because our customers prefer it is just not going to fly.
So let's say these law firms do care about diversity themselves, that they are pursuing diversity for its own sake rather than being pressured by clients for business reasons. Does that change this legal analysis?
Well, it changes how you go about the analysis, but I don't think it changes the conclusion. You know, whether we're equating, well, under Title VII or 1981, we'd be looking for the actual reason the employer made the discriminatory decision. So let's assume that they're, you know, genuinely just want diversity. They're not doing this because of pressure. I mean, there are some narrow exceptions for when you can, for lack of a better word, discriminate to achieve diversity. But again, I don't think the law firms could take advantage of that. It's been a long time since the Supreme Court has considered Title VII cases. I mean, the big ones were Weber in the late 70s and then Johnson in the late 80s. I think, you know, if you look at how hard some of the civil rights activists have tried to stop the court from taking another Title VII case since then, I think, you know, everyone realizes that, you know, the affirmative action side would do less well today than they would have back in the 70s and 80s. But even if we take that old, more liberal standard, you know, the Weber-Johnson standard, you can only use reverse discrimination to achieve diversity if there's a manifest imbalance in the workforce. That is a gross disparity between, you know, minorities and non-minorities, or between women and men compared to the labor pool. And that's similar, again, to sort of the gross disparity that typically equal protection cases tend to look for. You know, also, even that liberal Weber court said that it's got to be, the preferences have to be temporary. They can't be intended to maintain a racial balance, you know, just to eliminate one. And again, there is not a racial there's not a racial imbalance right now for these firms to be remedying, and there's not a gender imbalance. And again, whether we're looking at it under the Weber standard or equal protection, there'd also be some form of narrow tailoring involved. The Weber court talked about not unnecessarily trammeling the interests of white employees. Sounds a lot like the narrow tailoring we get under equal protection. And that would, you know, that would be, I would think, at very least, that these law firms would have to try to find race-neutral alternatives. But again, I don't think you ever get to narrow tailoring because there's just not a imbalance, no less a you know, huge disparity that they need to remedy. You know, I think the ultimate conclusion here would be that they really do not get, you know, again, even though it's been a long time since the court has ruled on diversity as an excuse for racial preferences, I think it's pretty clear that even under the old standard, the old, more liberal standard, that the law firms would fail here.
So taking an eye off of the law firm, what about the client's demands for gender diversity? Are those lawful?
Well, I'm going to try to stay away from the clients, but the client's behavior. But you know, let me just talk about how the law firms respond to it and whether that's legal. The analysis is similar, except that 1981 is not applicable. That applies to race, but not gender. And then also, Title VII does have a BFOQ, a bona fide occupational qualification defense for discrimination, gender discrimination, unlike racial discrimination. So we do have to sort of, look at whether customer preference would be an excuse here. You know, I think the courts have been pretty clear that you know, most of what we would call, you know, catering to customer preferences does not qualify as a bona fide occupational qualification under Title VII. The case I always remember, it's a long time ago now, is a Pan Am case. I guess the younger people on this call probably don't even know what Pan Am is, but was once a very successful airline, and they, you know, overtly discriminated against men in hiring flight attendants, based not just on their own belief that people preferred female stewardesses, as they called it at the time, but surveys that showed that the overwhelming percentage of their customers wanted women. The Fifth Circuit, that case didn't reach the Supreme Court, but the Fifth Circuit found that despite those customer preferences, that allowing the discrimination would really be contrary to the purpose of Title VII, since how do you you know, remedy these stereotypes if you cater to them? And you know, courts have done a similar analysis today, such that you know, to fall under the BFOQ exception for gender, it really has to be something where either the other gender can't perform the job, or so few of them can perform the job that it wouldn't, you know, that we wouldn't require you to look for the few that did. And, you know, the job gender has to, you know, sort of a related qualification has to go to the essence of the business operation. You know, obviously, if you're looking for dancers for a gentleman's club, being female does go to the essence of the business operation. That's clearly not the case here. Trying to think of some more examples where it would, you know, things relating to like sexual privacy, you know, an attendant in a restroom, you know, things like that. So I don't think this really even comes close. And, you know, if you think about it, they're not even really claiming that, you know, this is a job that that only women can do or women can do better. They're just saying, you know, these corporations and the law firms that listen to them are just are saying, hey, men and women are both great lawyers. We just want the right ratio of men to women. So, again, I don't think the BFOQ thing is going to fly at all here. And, you know, so let's also take that sort of second possible excuse, which is, well, we're not giving in to the pressure. We just, you know, we just like diversity ourselves. Well, again, the Weber-Johnson standard applies to gender as well as to race. So you would need to have a manifest racial imbalance or under equal protection language, gross disparity. And that's just not the case. You know, all the statistics I've seen show that, you know, women are represented at the big law firms in approximate proportion to the qualified labor pool. Now, there might be, probably are, small firms out there that, you know, that have a manifest imbalance of women or minorities, but that's not who this pressure is falling on. You know, this pressure is falling on the major law firms whose names we all know, where they're already doing a very good job, legally or illegally, of having diversity.
So now, what do you think are the best arguments out there in favor for a push for law firm diversity?
Well, I mean, certainly the arguments you hear made are, you know, the usual ones about diversity, both that it's, you know, it's valuable in its own, you know, that it's a societal good, and that also, you know, you need diversity in order to compete in today's modern economy. Although, if you think about it, that second argument sounds a lot like the customer preference argument, and therefore would fail. But you know, I mean, even if we were to concede that there's value in a diverse workforce, diverse group of attorneys, you also have to consider the you know, the price that minority attorneys pay for these preferences. I mean, I know that these preferences are ostensibly set up to, well, ostensibly they're set up to help the firm and help society, but, you know, there's the sort of hidden agenda of helping minorities. But if you look at, again, Professor Sander did really good work on this in a couple of law review articles in which, you know, he talks about and shows evidence that, you know, the preferences lead to big disparities in the expectations and performance of minority attorneys. A lot of the partners expect less of the minorities because they know they were hired under a different standard. And because they were, you know, didn't perform as well in law school, they may not perform as well on the job, which is especially unfortunate if, you know, they could have gotten a job in, you know, a law firm that's maybe a little bit less prestigious and maybe they could have shone there, or shined, as the case may be. So, you know, I mean, Rick Sander talks about, you know, I mean, he interviews some minority attorneys. He talks about the, you know, the frustration and sense of failure that a lot of them feel, you know, when they're brought on and showcased as, you know, being representatives of diversity. But then at the end of the day, they're treated as you know, somewhat less capable than their, you know, white counterparts. And that just winds up reinforcing, you know, all the negative stereotypes that, you know, that these laws are supposed to be combating. So I think even if there is a lot to be gained from diversity, there's a high personal cost to a lot of these attorneys. You know, Sander's other article, by the way, talks about how, again, you know, strong racial preferences in law school admissions results in minority law students graduating at a lower rate, passing the bar at a lower rate. So it's a very different, you know, it's a very similar phenomena. The very people that civil rights activists would say you're helping, you're not necessarily helping, especially because, again, they could go to a different firm or go to a different law school maybe and do really well there. If this diversity is helping society, it might be at the cost of the actual minority law students and attorneys that are, in a sense, being used to achieve this diversity.
It is interesting to reflect on how it can cut both ways. Now, is there any prospect for actually challenging these efforts in court?
Well, first you would need standing. So in the case of suing the law firm, we'd be talking about, under 1981, like I said, you could sue the partners or even a senior associate who is supervising you. So you'd have to be denied a job or promotion, a pay increase, or, a work assignment that would ideally would have furthered your career. They would have standing to sue the law firm or one of its partners. Again, if you're talking about what we didn't really get into, which was suing the corporations, a law firm would have standing. I believe the partners, even an individual partner, would arguably have standing to sue there as well. If I were going to bring one of these lawsuits, I'd bring it, again, even though you have to use 1981 instead of Title VII, I'd bring it against one of the big tech companies because I think that's sort of the source of this problem. And I think it would have the most impact. I mean, it would certainly get the most publicity. Lawsuit against even a big law firm, a lot of people might not notice, but a lawsuit against, Google or Microsoft. I mentioned Facebook before, but Microsoft has recently been crowing about the pressure it's putting on law firms, as has HP. One of those big tech companies, I think you'd get a huge amount of publicity. Just look at all the publicity that came when that Google employee, criticized the internal diversity policies. Now, the hard part, so getting publicity for the suit would be easy. The hard part would be, it's even harder than, I think, finding a student to sue a university like in Gratz and Grutter or the University of Texas cases. A 17-year-old is probably more idealistic than your average law student or attorney who's going to think, do I want to ruin my career here? So it might be hard to find a willing attorney or a law student or a law firm or partner. But I sure hope somebody goes ahead and does it. I'm not in a position to do it myself, but I would certainly encourage those out there to think about it. I mean, this is one of those situations where the reality on the ground is so much out of sync with what the law is. Again, as I said earlier, even under the liberal Weber and Johnson standard, these law firms are violating the law. These corporations are violating the law. And, if you could just get a good suit, ideally the Supreme Court, but, even a circuit court decision could really do a lot of good here.
That is quite the high bar for someone to volunteer and
yes.
do that at the expense of business reasons, right?
Yeah, no, like I said, although I haven't been involved in suing law firms, I was involved in the Michigan cases, and I know finding plaintiffs for that was not easy. Barbara Grutter and Jennifer Gratz and Patrick Hamaker were very courageous. But like I said, they were still teenagers and idealistic, so it would be even harder here. But people have succeeded. We succeeded. That is, the Center for Individual Rights, which I was with, succeeded in finding plaintiffs in Hopwood and Smith, in Gratz and Grutter. Ed Bloom has been successful in finding plaintiffs. So, it is doable.
Absolutely. Kurt, is there anything you'd like to cover before we move to the audience Q&A?
No, I think I've talked long enough. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. Well, in a moment, you will all hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor and present a question, please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone at any point from here on forward. It looks like we have one question in the queue.
Hi, this is Corey Liu. Thanks for your presentation. I first want to just echo and say that I've been working at a law firm for a year now, so I've definitely seen how these giant corporations are putting huge amounts of pressure on law firms to look a certain way, and that definitely affects, you know, hiring and promotion and things like that. And I'm Asian American, and one interesting thing I've noticed, because I've been, you know, active in the Asian lawyers community, is that if you think about how the diversity criteria are counted, there's first like a grid that shows, you know, white, black, Hispanic, Asian, and the breakdown there. And there's another grid that shows men and women. And I guess one thing I've kind of noticed is, in terms of hiring and promotion, is that Asian women do seem to, you know, get more attention from the diversity people because they count double, right? And I've met an attorney who said, you know, she was a partner at a firm, and she said, you know, I know the reason why I've been given these opportunities is because I'm, you know, both a minority and a woman. I count twice, and she was proud of it. She thought it was a good thing. But isn't there some kind of a bit of a perverse situation here, which is where, I guess, you know, traditionally you've had, it's been all white and male, and now they're slowly, you know, one worker at a time trying to increase the diversity, but they're not going to be firing white people to increase diversity, right? So they're hiring very slowly, and so there's a huge pressure, I guess, on these companies to give, you know, more a much more attention to someone who's double minority, like a racial minority and a woman, versus a male minority. And so for those minority men, I mean, they've overcome hardships and the same experiences that the women have in terms of being a minority and not being part of the majority and all those disadvantages. And yet there's this extra disadvantage now placed on by the diversity committee folks who are trying to maximize the numbers while, you know, maintaining, of course, they're not going to fire themselves, right? So it creates this odd disparity. Have you noticed that, and do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes. I think you're definitely right about Asian men not faring nearly as well under this diversity regime as Asian women. And, you know, it points out one of the problems with this whole identity politics and preferences in general, which is, you know, when you're divvying the world up into the disadvantaged people who get a preference and the non-disadvantaged people, you know, where does a minority male, where do they fall? I mean, are they privileged because they're male, or are they disadvantaged because they're a minority? You know, what if they're a gay white male? Are they privileged because they're white, or disadvantaged because they're gay? I mean, so part of it is just a problem with this whole, you know, like I say, diversity, disadvantage, privilege way of looking at things. But I think that, you know, Asians have been particularly victimized in recent years by preferences. Certainly, if you look at some of Ed Blum's lawsuits against universities, you know, they stress that because in university admissions, Asians are sort of naturally overrepresented, more so than whites, that they're the ones who, you know, as you say, you're not going to fire the partner or a senior associate, but these schools are more than happy to not admit, you know, some of the Asians that otherwise would have gotten in to make room for blacks and Hispanics. And I think, you know, Asians more and more are getting victimized also at the law firm level. You know, my impression is that, you know, the percentage of Asians going into law was less a few decades ago, and so it probably didn't affect them much. But because they do as well or better on average in law school, you know, and yet law firms know that they're not going to get extra bonus points for having you know, twice the proportional number of Asians. You know, Asians are starting to, you know, be hurt by preferences and you know, in law firms almost as much as they are in admissions.
Thank you, caller, for your question. We have two questions in the queue. If you'd like to call in, we still have plenty of time. Just press the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. Let's move to our next caller.
Hi. I'm wondering if really the true victims of this situation aren't the shareholders of the corporations. Essentially have to pad bills to the corporations in order to carry not quite the payroll or entice the business. So aren't the shareholders the ones who are the true chumps here?
Well, you know, the shareholders, unless they're sitting on the board, don't get a lot of say here. But maybe what you're suggesting is a shareholder suit. And that's outside of my area of expertise, but that might be a good idea as well. You know, again, I think a lot of this comes down to, you know, the difference in elite opinion versus, for lack of a better word, I'll just say, you know, the average American. I think most people and almost everyone these days is a shareholder in one way or another. Through their mutual funds or through pension funds. I think if you said, you know, are you okay with, you know, the corporation maybe having a legal talent that isn't as stellar as it might otherwise be in order to achieve diverse legal teams, are you okay with that? Probably most shareholders would say no. But we know that the people who run these corporations are you know, whether for virtue signaling reasons or whether they really believe it, are, you know, just completely committed to this idea that, you know, diversity is you know, the greatest virtue in society.
Thank you for your question. We have one more question in the queue. If you'd like to call in, just press the star key, then the pound key. Before we move to our next caller, I just want to announce that our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for Monday, September 18th at 3 p.m. Eastern. It will be regarding the European Commission's recent Google decision. Please keep an eye out for any emails regarding these upcoming Teleforum calls, and you can find all this information and more on our website. Just visit the events page and the Teleforum subpage. Let's move to our next question. Caller, your phone might be on mute. Can you hear us? Well, I'm afraid we cannot hear the person that just called in. Again, the queue is open. So press the star key and the pound key if you'd like to make any comments. Kurt, in the meantime, is there anything that you'd like to bring up before we finish the call today?
Let me see. You know, I certainly would be, you know, interested in hearing from, you know, anyone in this audience about empirical evidence of preferences at their firms. You know, I'm familiar with a lot of the global data, and you know, you don't have to be a detective to figure out that this overt pressure from corporations is resulting in differential hiring and promotion standards at law firms, which are, to say the least, solicitous to their clients. But it would be great to hear you know, examples from individual law firms. So if anyone you know, wants to share those with me, You can reach me at clevey, C-L-E-V-E-Y, at committeeforjustice.org. Or you can get my, you can find our phone number on our website, which is 202-270-7748. But I would love to hear, you know, even if it's anecdotal evidence from individual law firms to, you know, maybe add a more personal side to what the statistics and the press releases from these corporations indicate is happening.
It looks like we have another question in the queue. Let's move to our next caller.
Hi, Kurt. I had a question. I'm looking at a headline from last year in the Seattle Times about a large law firm that says, quote, to offer 15% discount to startups with female executives. And it seems to me it's going the other direction, where you have law firms saying, depending on the gender of the client, we'll offer you a discount. I know there were bake sales, I think, at, you know, university campuses where some groups try to demonstrate how silly that is to charge different prices to different, at least in that case, racial groups. And I'm wondering, have you given any thought to the validity or the legality of those kinds of things where law firms discriminate in their pricing based on the nature of the client's gender, race, or whatever?
Well, I think if you're talking race, then that definitely falls under 1981. Of course, gender isn't covered under 1981 because you're talking about racial discrimination in a contractual relationship. You know, it's funny when it comes to, as you point out, when it comes to offering discounts, it depends who offers it. If it's done, you know, genuinely in the name of diversity, then that's considered to be a great thing. But if it's done, as with these bake sales, to, you know, to make a point about why preferences might actually be demeaning, then of course it's a terrible thing, and the school cracks down and says you can't do it. You know, I'm not familiar with any cases like that. I mean, you often see things like that on a local level, where someone will sue the you know, the nightclub because it you know, lets women in for free, and you know, sometimes they win and other times they lose. So I haven't really done the research to know to what extent you know, this would apply, whether you could find you know, state or local law that would help you when it comes to giving women cheaper rates. But again, 1981 should definitely apply to basing those discounts on race.
Thank you, caller, for your question. We'll take one brief moment for anyone that would like to type in the star key, then the pound key for a final question. Looks like we have another question. Moving to the next caller.
Hi. Hi, Kurt. Thanks for the information. I was just wondering if you had heard of what's been referred to as the Mansfield Rule, where a number of law firms are now endeavoring to have at least 30% of their candidate pool from women and minorities, and taking affirmative steps to make promotion. And sort of the carrot and stick scenario is where these large companies are affirmatively saying, we will give you access to our executives if you meet this sort of quota, this 30% quota. I was hoping you could comment on that situation.
I'm sorry, what do you mean by access to our executives?
Well, supposing that the firm complies and achieves 30% status of women and minority lawyers, or promotion and hiring, the clients will then give these firms, or the minorities in particular, access to higher up executives.
You mean for career advancement purposes?
Career and business development.
Yeah, I mean, that's a little harder, because that kind of sounds to me like, you know, the sort of recruitment type where people challenge the doing more aggressive outreach for minorities. And courts tend to uphold that You know, maybe not so much based on the law as just sort of a gut feel that it's less objectionable, although it really is discrimination when you come down to it. So I don't know enough about the details here, but if it has that feel that you're just you know, that you're just giving them sort of more opportunities to network and advance, and you're not actually giving them a job or an assignment based on race, then, you know, my guess is it would be upheld in the courts, even if you can't come up with a, you know, good legal reason why it should be different, since, of course, it ultimately will lead, even if it's something amorphous like networking opportunities, it ultimately will lead to a better job and better pay. That's the whole point. But again, just as a realist, I'm thinking it would be hard to challenge.
Thank you for your question. We have one question in the queue. Let's move to you, caller.
Again, this may be outside your area of expertise, but the American Bar Association, in particular, state bar associations have been very aggressive in promoting diversity in law firm hiring, service to what they considered marginalized groups. Are there ways that the professional rules of conduct might be used to discourage some of this preferential treatment that isn't grounded in either actual need or grounded in some sort of specific historical pattern of discrimination?
Well, when you're talking about the ethics rules, you're generally talking about a complaint being filed with the bar. So I guess who would who would file the complaint? I guess it could be a white lawyer or a law student who said that, you know, this pressure from the bar is making it harder for them to find a job. The problem is, again, it's the bar that's going to adjudicate it, and very hard to imagine. Given the statements that these bars all seem to make about diversity, hard to imagine winning that complaint. But maybe just filing it would make a good point if you could get some publicity for it.
We've seen cases, for example, where a woman lawyer declined to represent a man in a property division upon divorce, and she was fined. That's the Stropnicki case. And so
But you're talking about actual, okay, so you're talking not about saying that it violates some rule of ethics to promote diversity, but you're talking about actually refusing a client. And
that was a specific case. And it seems to me that there may be some comparable causes of action, but you're unaware of any cases where either prospective candidates for positions or have been successful, because I know the rules can sometimes be used as evidence in, you know, civil litigation.
You know, I'm not aware of it. That certainly doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. But in all the discussions I've had about this, I haven't heard of it. So it may be that maybe we need to do more to encourage that. I don't know.
Thank you.
Thank you, caller, for your question. Kurt, is there anything you'd like to say before we close today?
No, just thank you very much for the opportunity to discuss this. A lot of people sort of grumble about it quietly, and they're afraid to say anything. So I think the more that, people on this call and other like-minded people can speak up about this and make others aware of it, I think that alone will do some good.
Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I would like to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast.
For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.